company. Mr. Shapiro.
May it please the court, Steve Shapiro on behalf of SDC. We're here today to contend that the district court's decision in this case is at odds with the language of the 96 Act and with the FCC's interpretations of it. The 96 Act contains four broadly worded savings clauses, one of which says that state law is applicable in commission proceedings under Section 252. This is 252E3 of the statute. And this law has been construed by the FCC to give the states broad latitude to flesh out federal criteria with their own laws and standards. That language is in the FCC's rules. The states can have their own laws and standards. And of course, rate making is and always has been a legislative function. And for many years, legislatures have supervised their agencies in this field. And there's no hint that Congress meant to preclude this traditional practice.
Mr. Shapiro, before we get too far into the merits, I'd like to spend some time exploring the redressability question that was the subject of supplemental memos.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to start with the question, what is SBC entitled to do in the wake of the district court's opinion? Do you read the district court's injunction as affecting the rates SBC can charge?
Yes, Your Honor. The injunction prevents us from implementing the final order of the ICC.
Where does it say that?
Well, it says both parties are enjoined against implementing.
Enjoined from implementing the state statute.
Yes.
Is there any reason why tomorrow morning SBC cannot set whatever charge it wants and then leave to AT&T a complaint to the Illinois Commission followed by federal judicial review?
Your Honor, our view is, and I know it's AT&T's view as well, that this injunction precludes us from charging those new rates.
The problem is it doesn't say that. Not only does it not say that, it doesn't seem to preclude the SBC from charging any rate it wants. Let's step back. Forget about the rates established by the Illinois Commerce Commission's order. Is there anything that prevents the SBC simply from declaring whatever rate it wants tomorrow morning?
Yes, we read this order as doing just that.
No, forget this order. Is there anything that prevents SBC from setting whatever rate it wants tomorrow morning?
Well, it would have to use the TELRIC approved rates that the ICC has adopted.
Haven't they expired?
In this
why this arbitration was ongoing?
The 98 rates were in effect until the new rates were promulgated by the ICC in June, and now those are the new rates, but we can't put them into effect.
What makes the 1998 rates continuously effective?
They're no longer continuously effective. We believe they've been superseded by the new rates adopted by the commission in this proceeding, but those new rates have been suspended by the injunction. We read the injunction as stopping us from putting into effect the new prescribed rates. And
Mr. Shapiro, the question I'm asking is, forget the new rates. What is it about? Is there some language in the 1998 agreement that makes it binding forever until the Interstate Commerce Commission changes it?
Well, there's language in the interconnection agreements themselves that says that we're obliged to charge the agency-approved TELRIC-based rates, and those are the 98 rates until they're changed by the new regulation, the new order. But we do read this order as preventing us.
It might help us if maybe within 7 days of argument the parties provided us with copies of that language, because
yes.
what the rates can be independent of this injunction may affect the reviewability of the injunction.
We'll provide that, Your Honor, in a supplemental memo.
Thank you.
To focus for a moment on why the General Assembly passed this statute, it was concerned about dwindling investment in the telephone system, which is a matter of life and death importance to the people in the state. We all know what service outages and interruptions can mean for the public. And there was a strong local interest in passing this law, and we think that that's what the savings clauses in the statute are all about, preserving state laws that serve these important localized purposes. And we submit that this isn't just a matter of statutory construction in this case, it's also a matter of constitutional principle. Federal courts should not interfere with the organization and the structure of state government without some clear command from Congress.
But
and
I
that command doesn't
this,
exist.
I don't see how this does that. I mean, if the Illinois, that's actually the question. The question on the table is whether the legislation from the General Assembly has simply provided some sort of appropriate guidance to the Illinois Commerce Commission, you know, meet these hours in the day or hire these experts or do something, or whether, in contrast, the Illinois General Assembly is telling the state agency to do something inconsistent with the federal legislation. We've seen examples of both of those things in Wisconsin, as you know. The Wisconsin legislation was telling them to do something they couldn't do under the legislation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so it strikes me in this instance, nobody's interfering with what Illinois is doing. I think it's absurd to say that the General Assembly could be the state commission since they're not the type of body that creates a record and does all of those things. But let's put that to one side. Why are these unbundled rates and why are the provisions that the General Assembly has passed consistent with TELRIC? Well, don't they tell you to look at SBC's own experience instead of the hypothetical carrier?
Well, we agree that the rules and standards have to be consistent with the 96 Act and the regulations. There has to be procedural consistency and substantive consistency. Now,
start with procedural consistency.
Yes. In a B case that you referred to, Your Honor, from Wisconsin, the problem was that the state provision, the tariff, displaced interconnection agreements, displaced arbitration, displaced federal court review.
Now, why didn't this, by suspending the arbitration, do exactly the same thing?
Well, it simply provided standards or inputs to be used by the agency. Congress has said in Section 252E3...
It didn't simply do that. It said, pending arbitration is prorogued, and then it said the ICC has to do the following, and when it does that, it will be treated as if it were the arbitration. It really did. I mean, the legislation is pretty plain. It says pending arbitration is terminated.
The pending case was not an arbitration. It was a generic...
Pending proceeding is over, and now we're going to say, we're going to pretend that this was the arbitration. That's what the statute says.
Yes, two inputs were provided on fill and depreciation out of hundreds of inputs that go into these prices. All the old inputs were from the 98 proceeding. Everything else was the same as the old rates. There were just two changes on fill and depreciation, and the legislature picked from among options that had been bluffed by the FCC. Actual fill is permissible. The FCC has approved that in prior orders. It's considered making actual fill mandatory across the whole country in its new rulemaking, and it has said repeatedly that actual fill is permissible.
But they've just, no, the new, I mean, it's just a notice of proposed rulemaking where when you look at it, they're just posing questions to the public to comment on. Seems to me hard to draw too much from that.
Well,
they could abolish TELRIC tomorrow, I suppose. Just because the Supreme Court has said you can do it doesn't mean that the Supreme Court has said that's the only way to do this.
Of course, it's the plaintiff's burden to show actual repugnance in a preemption case of this sort, and the FCC over the years in several 271 orders has said that actual fill is acceptable. They've gone below actual fill in New York. And they've said that SEC depreciation is acceptable, too, in their orders, in the triennial review. And the rulemaking is important because it summarizes prior standards. And what it says for the future is these things will not just be permissible, but they may be mandatory for the future. But they're permissible now is the upshot of these several FCC orders that we refer to. Now,
I don't read them as such strong statements as you do. And I'm not terribly persuaded that the thought that the Illinois General Assembly has quote-unquote only specified two elements, when those two elements prove to be such important elements, at least numerically, if they only said we're going to use the incumbent's cost base, not the hypothetical base, that would be pretty much the end of the discussion, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's helpful to look at the language of the statute, 252E3, which says nothing in this section shall prohibit a state commission from enforcing requirements of state law in its review of an agreement, in its 252 proceeding. And the conference report on that provision says that 252E preserves state authority to enforce state law requirements.
That's
in 252
proceeding. That's not inconsistent with the 96 Act. I mean,
yes.
It's all about whether there's an inconsistency.
Well, that's our view, too, that there is not an issue of procedural impropriety in this case. There's nothing wrong with prescribing standards and criteria. The FCC's rules say that.
One would think on that line that the only real question in this case is whether the bottom line reached by the interstate, by the Illinois Commerce Commission, was rates compatible with TELRIC. But that suggests that there's some procedural problem in this whole litigation. Did you suggest to the district court that it was a mistake to be reviewing independently these two elements as opposed to the general question whether the rates are TELRIC rates?
Well, we did say that a facial attack was not appropriate here, and the state commissioners said that the district court should stay its hand and wait for the agency to finish its work and then review these rates to see if they were consistent.
Review the rates under the...
Under TELRIC.
Yeah, one more question to make sure I understand exactly how this all works. The federal district court would review for compliance with TELRIC the rates set by the Illinois Commerce Commission.
It could do that, yes, in 252E6.
And my procedural question then is, why wasn't this recast as a 252E6 review proceeding, which would then ask whether the rates are compatible with TELRIC, as opposed to a proceeding that looked at 2 out of 100 components of the rate-making process?
It's very peculiar to us that they chose to bring this as a facial attack on the statute. Their theory was that the legislature has no business meddling in the subject matter, trying to supervise its agencies. Of course, that's been done in this country for 100 years.
Yeah, but that's a question independent of the question whether the bottom line is compatible with TELRIC.
Yes, and they chose to frame this as a facial attack, claiming that there was no possible way that this statute could be consistent with the federal criteria.
The reason I have a problem, though, with the way you keep posturing this, certainly if the General Assembly had passed legislation that says the Illinois Commerce Commission shall have no power to conduct arbitration, we would see that although the General Assembly has plenty of power to dictate what the ICC can do, in the context of this federal legislation, it means that the FCC would be doing certain things that state agencies do in other states. No one can compel the state to have even an agency, and if they take away a necessary power under this legislation, then this legislation isn't going to be what governs telephone rates in Illinois.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I agree with your premise. 100 years ago, there were no agencies of this sort, and the legislature, through the chairman of the Commerce Committee, would simply hold the hearing, listen to the cost information, prescribe the rates, the legislature would adopt them.
Right, now, but that's not the world we live in. We don't have to have appellate courts either, but if you establish them, they have to do certain things. And I would say, in this instance, Congress, when it passed the 1996 legislation, well knew that every state had an ICC, if you will, an equivalent to the ICC, and so they were trying this very complicated experiment in cooperative federalism, and they said, this is what we're going to do. But the backup, as this court's relied on, is that if the state doesn't want to do it, then the FCC will do whatever the state isn't doing. And it seems to me that your idea that somehow the General Assembly's power is at issue here isn't really right. There are procedural things that have to happen. The General Assembly these days doesn't sit down and take evidence and write records and hire things. No state legislature does that anymore. So I'm just not sure that issue really matters much. I think what Judge Easterbrook's talking about, you know, what's the bottom line? Can you just go out and establish rates? Why didn't you complain before that the rates you had were confiscatory, which seems to be your position in the brief? Nobody's forced to charge confiscatory rates, and apparently you couldn't persuade anybody that these rates were in the past.
Well, part of the legislative framework here was preservation of state law in the broadest possible terms, not only 252E3 saying that the state commissions are expected to apply state rules and standards when they do these arbitrations, but the General Savings Clause says no implied effect. This act and amendments shall not be construed to modify, impair, or supersede state or local law unless expressly so provided.
But of course, in the Wisconsin case, we held that it superseded the ancient state tariffing doctrines.
Oh, yes. There was an inconsistency there, Your Honor. The important thing there was our right to negotiate in good faith, to have an interconnection agreement, to have arbitration and federal court review just disappear. Now, these CLECs in the future can negotiate with us, they can arbitrate, and the federal court will
review. Let me ask you what happens when to the state statute when one moves to federal court. Suppose this lawsuit had never been filed. The Interstate Commerce Commission makes its rate finding, and AT&T then files a challenge in federal court saying these rates are not TELRIC rates. What is the status in the federal litigation of the state legislation? Is the federal district court bound to pay it any heed?
The federal district court would apply the statute unless it was inconsistent with TELRIC. The district court could decide if there were an inconsistency.
It's not whether the statute is consistent with TELRIC, but whether the bottom line is consistent with TELRIC. If the state agency adds $2 in one place and takes it out someplace else, one wouldn't independently challenge either the addition or the subtraction. You challenge the bottom line. That's one of the oldest doctrines of rate making, that you don't look at the components if the bottom line works. So the question I'm asking you is, what status in the federal challenge would any of these individual components have, as opposed to the question whether the bottom line is compatible with TELRIC?
Well, I believe that if you're reviewing the bottom line, and the bottom line is affected by the application of a statute that is inconsistent with federal law, which here it would be, there's a difference in the price that would result, the court could determine that there was a conflict between the state law and the federal law, so it would resolve that issue in the process of reviewing the bottom line. Now, in selecting the standards that it did, it's important to reflect that Illinois made a policy choice here, and
the just wanted to call your attention to the fact that the white light was on, but you carry on.
Perhaps I should save the time for rebuttal, unless the court has further questions.
Yeah, I'm still troubled by this question. In the federal review proceeding, if the district court concluded that the maximum TELRIC rate was $25 a month and SBC was charging $30, what would the district court's judgment say? Would the judgment say no rate greater than 25, or would it say change your fill calculations?
Well, I don't know of a single decision that said that a particular number like that is truly outside the broad range of discretion that the states have, but it could, I believe, say that fill factor affected the bottom line, and the fill factor, in our view, is inconsistent with federal law. But in fact, it's not. It's perfectly consistent with federal law. The FCC has accepted actual fills and accepted numbers in this range. We thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Shapiro. Mr. Carpenter.
May it please the court, David Carpenter for the appellees. Much as I'd like to win this case on non-redressability grounds, let me just explain how the interconnection agreement works and how the statute works and the significance of the injunction, just to clarify in response to some of your questions. The statute requires that rates be charged in accord with the interconnection agreement. That's 252C3.
And what was the duration of this agreement?
The duration is until it is superseded by another agreement. There's a minimum term or till it's superseded. Now, what's significant here is that there are provisions for incorporating the
results. Your view is that the agreement essentially locks in the power of AT&T to just say no.
Let me explain a couple of the provisions, because it's a little more complicated than that.
Right.
But the agreement provides for the incorporation of final rates set in ICC proceedings. And what's most pertinent here is that the agreement has a change of law provision. If there's a change in the statutory law affecting TELRIC, then there's a process that doesn't kick in until there's been a final determination whether the new statute is lawful. So here, by enjoining the implementation of the statute, we prevented the operation of the change of law provisions, and therefore, because the statute has been enjoined and SBC has been enjoined from implementing SBC is precluded.
I really hope the parties will explain this fully in their filing. Because it now sounds like the way you're describing the agreement itself contemplates an independent state rate-making proceeding.
The agreement incorporates...
I just want to make sure you understand why this is now bugging. If the agreement itself contemplates a state rate-making proceeding, it becomes harder to complain that the Interstate Illinois Commerce Commission has used some state principles in rate making. I mean, it looks more like our agreement allows the state to come up with its own rates, and then the way federal law is enforced is the subsequent federal district court review of those state rates.
Your Honor, what the agreement contemplates, what the SBC's rules allow, are consolidation of issues that could be raised in arbitration in things that look like rulemaking proceedings but are just the equivalent of multi-party arbitration.
That's kind of fuzzy. It doesn't sound like it is the statutory Telecommunications Act arbitration. I'm talking off the top of my head because I haven't seen this agreement. That's why I will be looking forward
to it. Well, the agreement is not going to be enlightening on this point. But what is enlightening on this point is that 252G allows states to address issues in consolidated proceedings and requires that the same procedural safeguards and same substantive requirements that apply in two-party arbitrations apply in these multi-party proceedings.
But is the backdrop of all of this the interconnection agreements? And if somebody's unhappy with the terms of an interconnection agreement, for example, SBC, after living with an interconnection agreement for a few years, comes to the conclusion that the rates are way too low to sustain continued investment and so on. The mechanism is then that they go back and ask for a new interconnection agreement, or they go to the state agency.
They can do either.
I thought the arbitrations were against the backdrop of trying to come to an interconnection agreement and failing, and then going.
Yes, what happens is that the interim rates are set in the arbitration because nobody can set final rates in 9 months' time. And then the agreements provide for the incorporation of the results in these other proceedings. But these other proceedings are governed by 252 of the Act, and the FCC's regulations make that explicit.
But they're not rate-making in the old-fashioned sense that you had various agencies just sitting down and deciding what the electricity rates were going to be or something. Aren't they tied up with this agreement basis in this day?
Yes, the agreement is the authority for these provisions, and these provisions are products, they're really just phases of the arbitration. The agency is deferring certain issues to other proceedings and doing them on a consolidated basis as Section 252G of the statute allows. But the key point is that the procedural protections of the Act expressly apply to these proceedings, as do the substantive protections. So the proceedings have to be conducted in accord with TELRIC. And as Mr. Shapiro says, the statute reserves state law authority.
Okay. So let me come back to a question I was asking of Mr. Shapiro about that. Why is this, or why should there be, a separate challenge to 2 out of 100 criteria? Why isn't the right thing to do to file a federal proceeding saying that the rates that the Illinois Commerce Commission set are not compatible with TELRIC?
Well, the statute requires that rates be set by considering only, the Illinois statute requires that rates be set by considering.
Look, if the National Labor Relations Board makes an order and it says reinstate 5 employees, the employer doesn't file a lawsuit saying the administrative law judge made the following error of law in the order. Instead, the employer tries to review the Labor Board's final order of reinstatement. And what you've done is the equivalent of filing a lawsuit against an administrative decision seeking to litigate 2 out of 100 issues rather than to litigate the agency's order.
I understand your point, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, that when the question is whether rates are confiscatory, you look at the bottom line and whether the bottom line is in the zone of reasonableness. But in a 252E6 case, when federal courts review what agencies do, they apply ordinary APA review. This is a statutory question, not a constitutional question. And if the agency applies an erroneous legal standard, or if the agency violates the procedures required by the statute, then the agency order gets reversed and sent back to the agency, just like in a standard APA review.
No,
and
that's the problem. You didn't ask the district court to review the order. You asked the district court to review two antecedent issues.
No, Your Honor. The theory of our case was that the order that the statute required the agency to issue is an order that was going to be per se invalid because it was going to be based on the application of an erroneous legal standard, one inconsistent with TELRIC, and it was going to be based on procedures that violate 252 of the Act.
I understand what your argument is, but if this were a federal agency, the Federal Trade Commission, for example, suppose the Federal Trade Commission decides that it has jurisdiction over dentists, and it now is going to decide whether an agreement among dentists violates the antitrust laws. The Supreme Court has held that you can't, once the FTC makes its decision, you can't bring an independent suit saying, no, gee, you shouldn't assert jurisdiction over dentists. What you have to do is wait for the FTC to enter a final order and then seek review of that final order.
My
question is, why shouldn't we be following that same model here?
Because this statute required that rates be set within 30 days. Once the rates were set, we were going to be irreparably harmed. The only way we could prevent that irreparable harm
was
suing in advance.
The case I'm describing to you is FTC against Standard Oil of California, and the argument you have just made to me is the very argument that the Supreme Court rejected in the SoCal case. That they'll be irreparably harmed if they can't get early review because they'll have to obey the order pending final review.
Your Honor,
the Supreme Court said that that was not a good argument.
I would think that in this context it was a good argument. But the more important point is the ICC has acted. We amended the complaint to challenge the order that was entered under 252E6. While the preliminary injunction was briefed before this ICC order was entered, the permanent injunction was briefed thereafter. The parties stipulated that the same arguments that were made before were equally valid as applied to the order that was entered. So this is a challenge that, if it had any merit at all, it would have been a challenge to the preliminary injunction, not to the permanent injunction. And the appeal here is really from the permanent injunction, as all issues involving the preliminary injunction, I would submit, are really moving.
What do you mean it's really from the permanent injunction?
Well, there's two appeals, one's from the preliminary, one's from the permanent. I assume the entry of the permanent moves the issues involving the preliminary. If I could address the merits. Under the TELRIC standard for setting rates, the state is required to ignore the actual existing network and the financial books of the incumbent.
Isn't ignore way too strong a term? I don't see why, from the FCC's own decisions, evidence of the existing network and evidence about it isn't quite pertinent, even if what you're ultimately doing is trying to make
ignore way too strong a term. The rule says the following factors shall not be considered. But I think that just means you cannot base rates on the embedded cost. Certainly what the incumbent is doing now can be evidence of what's efficient.
You have to start somewhere, and FCC argues that, particularly because it's had this rate cap, it's in fact been under strong incentive to make those rates the current, efficient, hypothetical, you know, new network kind of rate.
Yes, it's certainly entitled to argue that existing practices are efficient. But the problem with this statute is that it requires that the rates be based on the existing practices, whether or not they're efficient, and without considering all the evidence that they are quite inefficient. And that violates TELRIC. With respect to fill factors, the FCC specifically said that a state commission that requires use of actual fill without considering what the forward-looking fill is, i.e. the fill that an efficient carrier reconstructing the network from scratch would achieve, is violating TELRIC.
Could I ask you another question? Getting back to the final judgment, defendants are permanently enjoined from implementing these provisions, namely 408 and 409 of the Act. Do you read that as reinstating the proceeding that was going on at the time the act terminated it? I mean, if you read all of 408, for example, mm-hmm. one of the things in 408 is the termination of the proceeding that was underway. And if you're now turning the clock back to the minute before this statute was enjoined, I want to know how much is enjoined. Because maybe
that's an interesting point. No one has read it that way. The proceedings haven't been recommenced. SBC hasn't done anything.
Right. But in the proceeding, the next provisions is 408 yeah. and 409. I don't know how to read that other than all of 408
yeah.
and 409.
Well, that could be. Yeah. But SBC hasn't read it that way.
It's pretty clear that state statute says that the ICC docket 02864 is hereby abated.
Yeah.
If that law is hereby enjoined, it's got that proceeding has to be unabated.
Yes. Well, all I can say is that no one has done anything in that now abated proceeding.
Well, sounds like the Illinois Commerce Commission is in contempt of court then.
Well, SBC is, because the next move was up.
Since it hasn't appealed.
Right? Well, done anything.
Yes. I'm blessed because that's not my problem.
You have enough to begin with, flying.
It's just addressing the merits of this case has been a problem. But as I said, that the statute requires the
Did anybody, by the way, suggest to the district judge that he write an injunction complying with Rule 65D, telling the parties what they actually had to do? Part of the problem, reason why we issued our supplemental briefing order a couple weeks ago. Part of the problem now explored is that this injunction is just terminally vague. No one can understand what it means. No one understands what anybody's duties are under it. One would hope that the parties would, when a district judge enters something like this, go to the court and say, please be specific.
Your Honor, this injunction, I regret to say, was drafted by the two parties and submitted to the court on stipulation that...
We don't have to give the court as credit for this.
If you're going to lecture someone, I think you have to lecture us. And I think our defense is that we knew what we meant. And there's really no disagreement between us and SBC about what it means.
Apparently not, because you don't know what consequence it has for the ICC. But you have to understand that, contrary to public belief, the judiciary does not have electrodes implanted in the brains of lawyers. So what you know it meant isn't necessarily what we know.
Well, that's a fair point, Your Honor. But as I say, the blame is ours, not Judge Koukouras's on that one. If I could just spend a minute on the procedural inconsistency. I've identified the substantive inconsistency. This requires the use of the existing practices regardless of whether they're efficient. And the FCC has clearly said that violates TELRIC. And their argument on that score is because sometimes states applying TELRIC had used actual practices or financial depreciation, then they can require it in all instances. That's like saying it because a clock is stopped is correct twice a day, you can require that people use it to tell time.
So I take it your position on what we were discussing earlier, if there are 100 factors and two of them are being applied the wrong way, you have to be arguing that it doesn't all kind of come out in the wash, if the final...
Remember, the point of the statute is that, first of all, that's a standard for confiscation, not for compliance with TELRIC. But there's no way for it to come out in the wash under this statute. It abated the proceeding in which we were addressing all the rate-making inputs and required that rates be increased on the basis of increases in two of the inputs, barred us from litigating as we were whether other inputs should be reduced in ways that would offset the increases. And that's a violation of the statute, because the statute requires that all open issues be decided in these proceedings.
So your argument is that by freezing the other, using the number arbitrarily, obviously, freezing the other 98 factors, even though they may have made sense within the context of the overall 1998 order, perhaps was impermissible. Maybe it didn't make sense anymore in light of...
Yes, we had put in evidence that the rate of return was too high, the allocation of joint and common costs were too high, that things had changed in our favor since 98.
Where's the language in Section 408 freezing the other elements?
It's that the rate proceeding, it abates the existing rate proceeding,
exactly.
And it requires that rates be adjusted based solely on adjustments to the fill factor and depreciation loss.
Solely.
So, and that's a violation of
the statute. Where's the language requiring it to be done solely on these factors?
I thought it was that the ICC said we don't have time within 30 days to do all of the things you want us to do, so we're not going to look at these other things, which is a commission act, if that's mm-hmm. right, not a statutory
exactly.
act.
And that might suggest that maybe the problem with this statute is the 30 days rather than the fill factor and depreciation rate.
Well, that's another problem.
I was thinking about computers is you can do searches for words like solely, and it's just not in the statute.
Yes, well, that was my characterization of the statute.
I can't find anything remotely like it. It just doesn't mention any of the other criteria.
It abated the proceeding in which we were addressing these other issues. It required a proceeding in which rates be adjusted based on fill factors and depreciation.
Right. Are you relying on the fact that, I mean, it does say the commission shall determine the specific required adjustments with respect to fill factors and depreciation laws, and then it talks about putting those adjustments into effect. So maybe that's where you're drawing the negative inference, that means you can't look at anything else.
Yes, and that's what the ICC held in its order, that it couldn't look at anything else. So this is a point that wasn't disputed below. In fact, the only argument that SEC has made, which it made for the first time in appeal, not below, is that we're not hurt by this because we hadn't challenged any of the other inputs. They waived it by not arguing it below, and the fact is that we did challenge the other inputs. We challenged rate of return, we challenged mm-hmm. joint common cost. And these are things that would have offset the effects of increasing fill factor and depreciation if there had been any basis for doing that, and if that had been consistent with TALREG. So that's one, you know, very clear violation of the procedural requirements of the Act, is that all issues be considered. In addition, the proceeding violated the Act in a number of other ways. The statute requires that the decision be made by on information submitted by the parties, that it be on a record sufficient for judicial review, that the burden of proof be on the incumbent, and none of those things were done. All the ICC did was rubber stamp what the FCC had proposed because that's what the statute required. In addition, the statute's been construed to impose a duty of reasoned decision-making on the agency, in which it explains the connection between the facts found and the result, and explains any departure from prior precedents. And here, the prior precedents of the ICC said that using actual fill and financial lives was inconsistent with TALREG. And here, there could be no explanation at all. So, in addition to the fact that the ICC applied a substantively incorrect and inconsistent standard that's inconsistent with TALREG, the procedures that it was applying violated TALREG. And it goes back to the fact that in addition to requiring the ICC to conduct rate proceedings that violate the terms of 252 and of the FCC's regulations, the General Assembly here was just usurping what the statute requires the Illinois Commerce Commission to do.
I had problems with the way Mr. Shapiro put that, and I also have problems with that. The General Assembly, I'll put it in the kindest way possible, I think was testing the limits of these savings clauses. There certainly is still room for the states to do some things, and some things they do might not be inconsistent with TALREG and might be perfectly reasonable gap filling. Other things might not be. So why can't they give it a shot, see if it holds?
Well, the statute requires that the open issues between the parties be decided either by the state commission or by the FCC. If there's any need for, you know, what Mr. Shapiro...
You think it just interferes with the negotiation dynamic?
Well, it interferes with the fact that when there's open issues between the party, like whether there should be intermediate standards, the statute requires that those be resolved either by the state commission or by the FCC. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Anything further, Mr. Shapiro?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one thought on procedural consistency. 252E3 does say to the state commissions, apply state law in your 252 proceedings. Everything is not subject to arbitration. The states have been given power to promulgate laws, standards and even rules that are not the grist of an arbitration. And this is part of the balanced framework of the statute. Now, counsel makes the point that there's some substantive inconsistency on the issue of fill. But the test for fill is projection or estimate of usage. It does not require a trial on the issue of efficiency. The FCC has never said that.
Counsel, Mr. Shapiro, do you agree with Mr. Carpenter's understanding that Section 408 prohibited the Illinois Commerce Commission from considering other criteria such as depreciation?
We understood it as saying that in this proceeding only two things are to be adjusted, but in the next proceeding, if any other input is out of date, the commission is free to adjust those 98 other factors.
But that's an input by input analysis, right?
Yes, and but
it's awfully hard to see how that could be viewed as consistent with TELRIC. It's one thing to say that in applying TELRIC, two particular factors can be adjusted. It's another thing to say that the state has the power to promulgate rates based on only two criteria and leave the others, everything else that's relevant under TELRIC, on the table unadjusted.
Well, these are the only factors that the legislature thought required clarification now, but the others can be addressed in the future, and we certainly don't oppose that if any of them are out of date, but there's never been any contention that they are out of date. What the legislature did was to pick among these inputs that the FCC had approved. Actual fill and FCC depreciation are both within the range of acceptability under FCC criteria. The legislature asked to simply rerun the 98 numbers using these two changes in inputs. That's what was done. If in the future somebody says cost of capital is out of date or the hypothetical network has changed, that would be grist for yet another proceeding. The Walsh case from the Supreme Court, I think, sheds a lot of light on this case and its posture. The Supreme Court insisted there that courts not speculate about conflicts. When an agency has a technical issue in front of it and there's a rulemaking proceeding pending, the court should not strike down a state law based on these very speculative assertions.
Thank you, Mr. Shapiro.
We thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. The case is taken under advisement.